Philosophische Brocken auf Orange 94.0 und im Internet unter http://audiothek.philo.at.
Einen schönen guten Nachmittag. Hier sind die philosophischen Brocken, am Mikrofon Elisabeth Schäfer. Heute mit akustischen Brocken aus einem Abend mit Helene Cixous. Am 20.03.2014 war die französische Philosophin und Schriftstellerin Helene Cixous für einen Abend zu Gast im Tanzquartier Wien. Die Veranstaltung wurde in Kooperation mit dem Tanzquartier und dem Passagenverlag mit freundlicher Unterstützung der Kulturabteilung der Stadt Wien, Emma Sieben und der Gerda Weiler Stiftung von Esther Hutfles, Gertrude Postel und Elisabeth Schäfer organisiert und konzipiert. Im Wort der Frau wie in der Schrift hört nie auf mitzuklingen, was, weil es uns einst durchdrungen und merklich tief berührt hat, die Fähigkeit behält, uns zu bestimmen, das Singen, die erste Musik, die der ersten Liebesstimme, die jede Frau lebendig bewahrt, schreibt Helene Cixous. Es ist dieses unmerklich tief und immerfort mitklingende, das die Schrift oder besser das Schreiben von Helene Cixous bewegt. Jede Stimme, ganz gleich, ob sie verständliche Worte spricht oder fremde Laute gurrt, ist, sobald sie ertönt, von einer Plötzlichkeit und Entsetzlichkeit. Sie entsetzt uns, weil sie uns bewegt. Es ist die Kraft der Stimme, uns anderen Orten zuzutragen. Orten, an denen wir noch nicht waren, zu denen wir nicht gelangen konnten oder wollten, Orten, die unerhört geblieben sind bislang. Spricht die Stimme uns Worte, so können wir rasch auf ihre Plötzlichkeit und Entsetzlichkeit vergessen. Wir beruhigen uns am Verstehen, am Verstehenden hören, so wie uns das Lesen tröstet. Wir machen einen Schritt nach dem anderen. Wir schieben uns langsam und in geordneten Formationen vorwärts im Text. So können wir auch mit den Ohren lesen. Im Raum der Hermeneutik geht es geordnet voran. Anders, wenn die Stimme nicht spricht, wenn sie nicht im Kleid der Worte daherkommt, wenn sie singt, wird sie schon komplizierter. Wenn es der Atem ist, der hörbar wird, neben, unter, mit der Stimme. Wenn die Stimme schreit, zirpt, zwitschert, gurrt, sägt, bebt, summt, brüllt, dann reichert sie sich besonders wahrnehmbar mit jener Dimension an, die sie immer wie einen unsichtbaren Mantel trägt, das andere zur Ordnung des Diskursiven, den Körper. Der Mantel der Stimme, den sie stets trägt, jener des Körpers, des Taktilen, kehrt sich ins Hörbare, ins Wahrnehmbare. Wir können es nicht länger überhören. Die Stimme wohnt in einem Körper, sie kommt aus dieser Wohnstätte heraus, reicht bis zu anderen Körpern hin, sie will dorthin, sie durchquert das Zwischen, sie entäußert sich selbst als ein Körper. Denn wie sonst dränge sie so wuchtig hervor und an uns heran, berührte uns so sehr, wie es eben nur ein Körper kann. Es ist dich berührend, die mehrdeutige Vielstimme, die dich bestimmt, die dich von deiner Brust aus dazu drängt, zur Sprache zu kommen, die deine Kraft aufkommen lässt. Es ist der Rhythmus, der dir zulacht, innerster Empfänger, der alle Metaphern möglich und begehrenswert macht, Körper, nicht beschreibbarer als Gott, die Seele oder das Andere, schreibt Helene Cixous. Es ist mit ihr, also die Stimme, oder präziser, es sind die vielen Stimmen, die uns ins Schreiben drängen. Ein Schreiben, das sich nicht um die Wahrheit des einen Logos schließt, sondern eines, das sich beständig offen hält. Und so drängte es die Veranstalterinnen des Abends mit Helene Cixous dazu, jenes polyphone Schreiben in die Stimmen sich tragen zu lassen. Davon gibt es nun einige Brocken zu hören.
Set immortality in motion again. From a great distance, from the far end of the Cave of Secrets, Peter Ibbotson returns. I open the window. I hear his child's voices. Reading starts again. We were sick with death. The seed picks up again, during which the thousand sensations emanated from the depth of our good health follow the infinite movement of our thoughts and make up around it. From the flower of all our unconscious well-beings, the honey of a soft golden pleasure, which mingles with our ardent meditation like a quiet smile. Books deliver us, make us delirious, lead us into the garden of Anland, where the flowers grow, whose adored names we had forgotten, where under the clumps of thyme, perhaps, I find the keys to the gates of immortality. Book is something else then, the real book, the one which has all the strengths of the inner fecundities, is that the one which has the power of communication, which communicates this power to us while leaving our solitude intact. How does communication take place? Via telepathic response, I'd say. It's as if a book, which I do not know, which I believe I do not know, which I believe I do not ask anything from personally, were only just responding to me, while itself asking my own questions in front of me, in its language, whereas I said nothing, I say nothing. Takes place in a foreign land where I have never been, yet it is mine. I don't return from it. I cannot believe it.
Discussion. The two participants I have not yet introduced so far are my colleagues, co-editors and friends, Esther Hutfles and Elisabeth Schaefer. Esther Hutfles works as a philosopher in Vienna, and she's also a lecturer at the Department of Philosophy at the University of Vienna. She's a psychoanalyst under supervision at the Wiener Arbeitskreis for Psychoanalysis. The focus of her publications and research is phenomenology, psychoanalysis, deconstruction, post-structuralism, and gender studies. And Elisabeth Schaefer also works as a philosopher. She's also a lecturer at the Department of Philosophy at the University of Vienna. And she, in addition, holds a postdoc position currently at the University of Applied Arts in Vienna, funded through the Austrian Science Fund for a project on artist philosophers, and she also has been involved and will be involved again in the Philosopher on Stage project that some of you might know. Her publication and research emphasis is on deconstruction, feminist philosophy, écriture féminine, and corporeality. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chiara. So, we will continue speaking, which is not an easy task after what we just experienced right now, but so try to come back into the spoken words. We have a lot of questions, but I want to tell you first that there is also the possibility for the audience afterwards, after this discussion, to also pose questions to all of us here, and in particular to Helen Siksu, of course. So in picking up what just happened, what we just experienced here on stage, I would like to ask you, Hélène, concerning écriture féminine as a practice of writing and thinking, which always cuts the edge of poetry and philosophy. What would you say, philosophy and literature, philosophy and art, in a broader sense, are interrelated? Would you say philosophy needs art?
Yes, of course. I mean, I don't think that a philosopher can do without art. It's really, it's impossible to separate. Philosophy is an art. There are philosophers who have actually philosophized on being artists, like Nietzsche, of course. And I don't think that we can imagine a philosophy that reaches the heart if it's not an art. Let ourselves be enchanted by Plato. If we don't resist its charm, then we are carried away in a kind of drama of extraordinary theater of thinking, and that's simply a staging of voices, of different voices. But I think that the nobility of philosophy is reached when philosophy can sing, can laugh, can create, and also can self-portrait itself, can be the painter of the uncertain and undecided painter of its own thought.
Okay, my question goes in a rather different direction, namely the political implications of writing that I see in your texts from very early on. I live in the United States, and they have by now writing programs pretty much for every marginalized group. There's writing projects for immigrants, for women, for prisoners, for whatever. And I'm just wondering whether or how you would distinguish between a kind of transformative style of writing and an affirmative style of writing. So it looks like not any writing is really leading to political change. So how would you draw the line here?
Of course, this is it's a tough question. I don't think either that writing leads to a political change. Not directly, anyway. It's although there are moments when writing is associated with political action. For instance, in 1968 in France, when there was that huge movement of the students, they would write enormously. That is, they wrote on the walls, but that was very poetical. But of course, it doesn't change the world. Still, I don't think that you can change anything without writing. You're not going to be able to change a government, particularly because they are deaf. They have no ears. They don't care about writing, and they don't read. You yourself, if you want to change something, beginning with yourself, you cannot do it without writing. Or an equivalent, because it can be painting, or can be singing, the way Isabel sings, for instance, something that comes from the depth. But this cannot be achieved without some kind of poetical writing, something that displaces, that storms yourself. So, as I say, it's indirect, but it's absolutely necessary. Of course, it means poetical writing. Then, I don't want to despise or spit on the apprenticeship of mere handwriting, which, or you know, what you pointed at as the writing you transmit to prisoners or undocumented people, etc., etc. It's a tool. It's the first tool. They need it. They need it. That will help them grasp their own predicament. Then that's the first stage, exactly as feminism is the first stage of something that should go much further. Then, of course, it's only when you become Rimbaud, and people should become Rimbaud, that you reach a new kind of freedom. Well, everybody should try and become Rimbaud.
Thank you very much. I would like to continue here. My question is about the situation of women, which is an important part of the Medusa text. Within family theory and gender studies, the concept of sexual difference was very important, and now it seems that this concept disappeared in the recent years. And other theoretical approaches had become important too. For example, queer theory. And I would like to ask you how you think these two concepts could be brought together, and what can we do with the thinking of sexual difference today?
First of all, pluralize it. That is, put it into plural. And speak about sexual differences, and that is queer. When beginning to speak about difference, in the time when, for instance, Derrida opened the field of deconstruction, the state of society was simply deaf to all kinds of reflection or acceptation of any difference. They would think only in terms of equality, without difference, which for me is a loss. One should cultivate differences always. And when I say sexual differences, it's simply to point that, of course, a sexual difference is not one. It's a sexual difference with an A. It's a movement. I've always said that it's something that sexual difference happens and passes. In French, la déesse passe, la déesse passe. The différence sexuelle passes. It passes, that is, it happens and goes and vanishes. It's not permanent, it's not settled, it's not a settlement. It happens. And la déesse means in French the goddess. It's very elusive. And you cannot think queerness without thinking in terms of differences, of the movement of differences, or the movement of difference. The moment it moves, it's several. Now, maybe I should point to the fact that we also belong to... I don't see really a total distinction between thinking in terms of sexual differences and queer theories. I mean, it's just the consequence. Then the fact, well, I'm not really aware that one doesn't think in terms of sexual differences anymore, because the whole of literature is about it. But there are facts that we have to deal with, and those facts are market facts. The places where one speaks about those themes, which I don't want to call concepts, it's just, you know, moments in the life of thinking, are commanded by market values, makes it for all the places where this happens have a huge turnover. You know, you have to change the merchandise every 15 years or 10 years or 5 years. And and of course, this is the American way of thinking. Every 5 years, a new à la mode type of concept, because you have to sell. It's not thinking. As you know, there is a succession. There are a series of happenings in thought in order to sell, to market theory. So there are turnings. And there are also turnings in the marketing of idols. What name the 2014 idol, because it's already passed, and the next idol is coming. So I think that changes or disappearances are only apparent. You cannot evacuate. You cannot truthfully, realistically evacuate sexual differences. You experience them all the time.
What we just to this question, a note. What we found very interesting was that in the text you read today, you call the Medusa the queen of queers.
Mm-hmm.
This was something that this was important for us, and also, yeah, afterwards in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And we really liked the idea that Medusa is the queen of queers.
It's, you know, I should have called her you know, she's so, as my mother would call her, antique. She's an antique. She's so contemporary. She's so everyday. She's always in transition. And as I said, exactly as I said a bit earlier, that Shakespeare was the first Derrida, the Medusa has preceded and anticipated all of us. I think that we should come back on the reading of that of the meanders of the myth, because it's so rich. After all, she has appeared in remote times as the eternal icon. And she's fun.
Thank you. I would like to ask Isabel. I think that in experimental and improvised music, it's a little bit similar than in writing. It's very difficult for women to do it, and it seems to be still a mainstream not to use voice or breath. I mean, mainly instruments are used, they are in some ways deconstructed or de-instrumentalized. But we think what you're doing is something special in that scene. And we would like to ask you if you think that this is a special female approach in this kind of music, and what does it mean for you? I don't know if you can say it. It's always difficult to ask this to musicians and artists.
I don't know if it's a female approach. It's mine, that is true. A lot of musicians use the Greece, but of course, especially in the improvised music, but more with an abstract way and with a more concept way. And when I started to use my voice 10 years ago, because I'm a clarinet player, at the beginning, I wanted to do something with my voice, but I didn't know how to do. And this breathing was the more powerful things I have in my body, and it came in me. It was not a choice to use my voice like that, but it's more the voice came to me. So if I don't do that, I can do nothing. And but it's true. What is true? It's to be a woman and to make to play and to sing like that. I have really to believe in me, because it's not a normal way. And it's when if I scream, if I use really powerful this breath. It means your art and your work is some people I know, because I speak with the audience, that can be disturbed with that, and I have to I cannot do another things. And maybe if I would be a man, it would be very different with the same language, but because I'm a woman, it's disturbing, and I have really to know. I do that, and it's that. I have to say, I have to sing, and it's that. It's in my body, and I can do even if I'm a woman.
Yeah, thank you very much, Isabel. You just said it's not the voice you are choosing, but it's a voice coming to you. That might be, I don't know, that might be similar to Claudia, because as a translator, I would like to address you now as a translator, the texts are coming to you in a special way. So, and as we might know, translation happens to be a most relevant subject in deconstruction. There's a lot of theory about translation, what we could understand as translation, and given that background, what would you say are the most particular challenges for you when translating texts from Helene Csikszu, when those texts are coming to you? What would you say are the challenges for you?
I think for me, the biggest challenge is to try to be as fair and as just with the text being so intricate and so completely alive in every detail, every comma, every full stop, every letter, every word and every sentence is so utterly moving in so many different directions of sense, that necessarily translating is a very the risk is that to violate the text terribly and to maim it and to not be as intelligent as one ought to be with all its very live qualities. So it is actually you really must, in a certain way, learn to put aside the fear that might arise from this experience of the text, and in a certain way learn to trust your own language, which is as strong and as beautiful as of course as the language in which the text is written, but it has not been put into a form, of course, yet. And it's you have to try and find a form that is as little harm as possible to the text you want to translate. Of course, it's not possible, but in a certain way, knowing this and trying to be as athletic as you can, you just have to trust your own language and trust yourself and hope that that reading later what you've translated, you don't find too many awful mistakes. This is sort of the core of my experience. Then, of course, to give a very concrete example, there are you can find bypasses. For instance, the verb voler, the French verb voler, that plays such a key role in The Laugh of the Medusa, has in French two senses that are related. But of course, the Germans fliegen or stehlen, you would have to make a choice between fliegen or stehlen. This is a terrible amputation of what is in the text. But if the editor is helpful and the editors are helpful and the editor, yes, if everybody is helpful, then you are allowed to, for instance, use fliegen und stehlen to try and which is, it doesn't, das ist überhaupt nicht selbstverständlich, natürlich. So this kind of text asks for those kinds of people to allow these, es ist wie eine List oder ein bypasses.
I have a question to Helene Zissou. At the very beginning, you said beautifully that philosophy is in its noble aspect a kind of art in itself. I teach philosophy at the University in Vienna, and if I look around my colleagues, I'm not sure whether all philosophers of my department would share that definition which you gave right now. So my question, to take it seriously, is how do you see, you spoke about politics, about art, but how do you see the relation of your definition of philosophy, literature, écriture féminine, to the world of academia, and especially the interpretation that philosophy is science and philosophy is not a kind of art?
First of all, let me underline that I'm not a philosopher. I'm a writer, and it goes around the world that I'm a philosopher, so I can't quarrel with everybody. And sometimes I excuse myself by remembering that Derrida would say that's of course. A secret. He would say that first of all, there were so many philosophers who are not writers, which of course he thought was a pity. He thought that true philosophy had to be a writer's philosophy, or that a philosopher should be a writer. There were very few. then he would also point to the fact that there were writers who thought, because there are so many writers who don't think, and that is why now and then a modest writer like me is mistaken for a philosopher, because I think that you cannot write without thinking. This, of course, is a way of belonging to what I call literature. It thinks. It thinks poetically, and it thinks freely, more freely than philosophy. Philosophy has an ideal, a function, a duty. It's supposed to somehow, now and then, try to demonstrate something, which I think is both a noble vocation and, of course, a terrible obstacle, because you have to turn around all the time to check and be sure that people follow you. Philosophy wants to be followed. And again, Derrida would tell me, you're not didactic. I am didactic. And it's true, he would, in his writing, he would inscribe variations on a leitmotif or on a theme that had appeared inside his writing, and he would repeat it 10 times so that he would be sure that he would be followed. A writer doesn't care about being followed. So, as regards academia, I share your question. I belong to the academia. I used to think, actually, I have always benefited by a privilege, which is that I myself founded the university where I've been teaching forever, which is Paris 8, the experimental university, where everybody taught, I mean, Deleuze, Foucault, except Derrida, freely, without the injunctions of academia. So you could go wrong, you could dance in philosophy or joke, etc. It's everything that is prohibited was allowed. And I would think, that was a long time ago, I thought if this university had not existed with its craziness and its chaos, I don't know whether I would have stayed. I'm not sure I could have. I don't even know whether I would have been allowed to remain in a university. And I remind you that when Derrida wanted to enter the university, he couldn't. It was too late. He should have entered Paris 8, which he didn't want to do. And when he later decided that he maybe would be more comfortable in university, he was rejected. Simply because what he has brought to philosophy is a permanent earthquake, which the institution doesn't like. So I think that and I'm sure that if you're here, it's because you're able to participate in earth shaking, and this, of course, you can operate by means of poetical language. The great philosophies have always been poetical.
Yeah, maybe it's a rather simple question, but maybe a more complex answer, and I try to use the plural. So what are your thoughts about the males, but not in a sense of individual issues of men, but much rather like potentialities of maleness in Western society nowadays?
Is that a political question or of males?
No further background, but maybe just an observation.
I think we cannot do without mail. Even if we are in a time, as you know, where probably we approach the possibility of replacing everything, male, female, and everything by technology. I can imagine that. I mean, I can imagine that even biology will yield to technology. Male is a part of human sexuality. I don't know if that is what you were what you had in mind. The opposition or division that happens in political situations and only in political situations is between phallocrats and women. I mean, that is something very very banal, which haunts the memory and history and all of society. It makes for the fact that we have to start or begin again every 10 or 20 years the same type of deconstruction, and that will last for not forever and ever, but probably for another 500 years. But I cannot say anything that will deconstruct the male element in nature. I mean, it's there. What is interesting, of course, is when we cannot detect it, when we have a cat and we don't know exactly whether it's he or she, or when there's a man and you cannot say whether it's he or she, simply because that being can transcend opposition. In his, her, body and soul. Actually, you know, the question that you asked Isabel resonated for me, because I wondered really whether this was this. I mean, what she does, which is absolutely extraordinary, is I wondered whether, I asked myself whether men would do it as she does, and I thought, why not? Why not? Why not? What would probably slow the exercise? Because there are men who do that. I know that Mongolian do that, and in Japan, you have that type of use of the breath. But I think it's really something that has to do with daring to be archaic. But this is also a trait of culture. To, I mean, when women give birth, for instance, if you have experienced it, then they use their breath in this way. They breathe out something which has to do with creation, with tearing apart, etc. It's a fundamental experience. If you don't give birth, then you can give birth differently. By that practice that Isabel gave us a wonderful example of it. And of course, it's not forbidden for men, but it's probably more of a challenge for the usual, the common inherited structure of men.
I think we have time for one last question. I think
one more question, yeah. And then everybody is welcome to the reception. So if you have any further questions, comments, you can do it outside in the foyer. So one more question.
I would like to come back to the center of your work in a way. You
was already, there were many things you told about how it is inside your work, but I would come back to this question. You talked a lot of the movement of thinking, and you are, as a writer, in the movement of writing. And when I read your texts, I can experience the movement of thinking in a special way. It's very visible there, and I would appreciate a lot if you would like to talk a bit about the secret of the relation between the movement of thinking and the movement of writing in your work.
Oh, it's the same, you know. What animates writing is thinking. It's groping for inside darkness for a little bit of light. So creeping or jumping in that dark space where you're looking for something which signals but is not immediately visible. It's just the same thing as the Plato's cave, you know. It's very physical, the cave. You're chained inside a cave, and then it's through movement that you gradually climb out of darkness. That's the movement of writing. You're in darkness and you swim or fly, whatever. You use everything that you can, I mean, all the movements of your body, in order to reach towards an echo, a meaning, something that joins. That's it.